أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله القائل في كتابه وأن هذه أمتكم أمة واحدة وأنا ربكم فاتقون، وأشهد أن لا إله إلا الله قل اللهم مالك الملك تؤتي الملك من تشاء وتنزع الملك ممن تشاء وتعز من تشاء وتذل من تشاء بيدك الخير إنك على كل شيء قدير. وأشهد أن سيدنا وإمامنا وولي أمرنا محمدا صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم عبده ورسوله، وما كان الله ليعذبهم وأنت فيهم، وما كان الله ليعذبهم وهم يستغفرون. أما بعد، brothers and sisters, respected ulama, those of you who are organizing and coordinating, carrying what has to be carried, driving the distance that has to be driven, all of you who made an effort to be here this evening, I greet you with the greetings of peace and equality, justice, and the Islamic way. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I'm going to have to make some remarks at the beginning. I'd like to say, first of all, that sometimes inaccurate information circulates. And given the type of world we live in, if we are keen observers of those who are makers and shakers of public opinion, it's not a surprise to have skewed information about yours truly here before my arrival during the day that I was here, and it's probably going to linger on for some time for those of you who fall victims to the propaganda and the mouthpieces that are busy trying to malign or distort the image of those whose only task is to try to speak the truth and nothing but the truth. That's remark number one. Remark number two. Let's face it, as a whole, I'm not speaking about every individual, but as a whole, we suffer from the inability, first of all, to express the facts as they should be expressed, which is a very severe problem that we have. And the second problem that we have is that we don't even have the ability to listen to the facts if and when they are presented. This is a sad comment on us, but it's a fact. And the sooner we put this behind us, the better it will be for ourselves and for the coming generations of Muslims. The third remark that I'd like to make is that there seems to be certain Islamic centers, many of them, as a matter of accuracy, who more or less have yours truly here barred from access. And they can administer their Islamic centers the way they want to. But we pray for the day when Islamic centers are opened for all sincere Muslims, especially those who have spent a lifetime, or just about a lifetime, in the service of the Muslims. People in this position either report to you, the Muslim, the common Muslim, the normal Muslim, the grassroots Muslim, or they report to the paymasters, wherever they may be. And you can evaluate your administrations in Islamic centers accordingly. These were the remarks that I wanted to clear the air of, because I thought it's very necessary to mention that. The subject matter that we will try to concentrate our minds on, and I know from experience that sometimes we have a selective way of tuning in and then tuning out. May I request that I have your attention, your undivided attention, for this time period. And then later on, you can daydream and do whatever you want to do. I will begin this presentation, and I'm going to try as much as possible to remain within the context of the Quran and the Sunnah. That's something we all agree upon. That's something we all refer to. There's an ayah in the Quran in which Allah Jalla wa Ala says, إِنَّ الشَّيْطَانَ لَكُمْ عَدُوٌ فَاتَّخِذُوهُ عَدُوًا. Of a certainty, the shaytan is an enemy of yours. Therefore, designate him as an enemy. This is an ayah that is crystal clear in its meaning. There's no word that tolerates a range of give and take. There are ayat bayinat, and there are ayat mutashabihat. This is not one of those ayat mutashabihat. This is an ayah that delivers its meaning directly and straightforwardly. Inna shaytana lakum adu, fattakhidhuhu aduwa. When we look at our condition today, an observation was made during the course of these presentations, an observation was made that Muslims are lagging behind. We don't have an industrial base to be proud of. We don't have a scientific legacy that we can refer others to. We don't have an Islamic civilization in the accurate sense of the word. And the reason, and I have to be short, this is not a time to go into much details, but the reason, the short answer to that, and the reason for that is that we don't have an Islamic public mind. We run around with individual ideas. Some of them may be great ideas, some of them may be much less than that. But when we take a look at ourselves, around 2 billion Muslims, I know you probably seldomly heard that number, because everyone wants to undercut or to diminish or to decrease our numbers in the world. Feel comfortable that we are approaching 2 billion Muslims in the world. Now that makes the contrast even worse. There's 2 billion of you Muslims out there in the world, and you're not able to put together some type of unity and unity of purpose. You don't have any political solidarity. You don't have an Islamic commonwealth or economic market. You don't have any type of coordination in your defense policies. You don't have a common currency. What do you have? And the short answer that I'm giving you is we don't have a public mind. The day approaches when we do have a public mind, that will be the first day on a course in the right direction of re-establishing our Islamic civilization as it was meant to be. Of course, the reason here that begs a question is, well, why? Why don't we Muslims have a public mind? And you have multiple answers to this, and most of these multiple answers will be correct. You can rethink or bethink this question, and you'll come up with an assortment of answers. And we can beat around the bush, but we're not going to do that. The reason why we don't have a public mind can be attributable to the fact that there's a disconnect between our understanding of Islam today and the understanding of Islam when it became a civilization. And let me remind some of the hasty individuals around, a civilization you cannot build in a year or a decade or a generation. A civilization is in the making for generations and centuries. An Islamic civilization, when we had the universities of the world in our domain, when we had students coming from all parts of the world to those outposts of knowledge, whether they were in today's Iraq or whether they are in today's were in today's Iberia. That was a cumulative effect of years of who we are. And those building block years are the years in which the Prophet of Allah anchored not a defeatist understanding of Islam, but a forward-moving understanding of Islam. When we take a look at Allah's Prophet, now I hope no one's going to argue, unless, you know, we have some stray individuals here and there, but I don't think any of them are around here. No one will argue that Allah's Prophet is our reference and our recourse, our prototype and our model. And Allah's Prophet, of course, had this Quran that was being revealed to him throughout a course of 23 consecutive years. And Allah's, listen, we're speaking about Allah's Prophet. We're not speaking about me and you. We're speaking about a person way ahead of all of us. When he was in his own society, did he or did he not have enemies? Someone's going to have to think. If we're going to accomplish something tonight, hopefully, it's going to be that you begin to think. If Allah's Prophet, and he is who he is, he's the beloved of Allah, he's the most honorable of Allah, he's the closest to Allah, he is all of what we know of him, and yet, he couldn't help it. He had enemies. Anyone, as primitive as you are in understanding his seerah, you still know he had enemies. And because of those enemies we have in our seerah, in our study of his lifetime, we have ghazawat and we have saraya. These were military campaigns. These were wars and battles that he either attended or supervised. This is our beloved Prophet. Now, because of the damage that has been done to our psychology, we have people who walk around with the appearance of Muslims, those who say that they are keen on following Allah's Prophet, but they don't want to have enemies. How do we understand? How can anyone understand this? How can you square this? How can you have leaders in today's world who want to be enemy free? You can't do it. If you're following Allah's Prophet, you're going to have enemies. That's the first fact that has to go into the making of our public mind. And if you choose something else, be advised, you have stepped out of the parameters of Allah's book and Allah's Prophet. The second issue that goes into the building of an Islamic public mind is that we have to define our relationships with each other. We have the type of Muslims who cannot make way for differences of opinion. We don't know, this is going to need a lot of study to try to get down to the nitty-gritty of where this comes from. Why Muslims cannot tolerate another valid opinion. This is a type of disease that we have. And we're not going to put together a Muslim public mind before we treat this disease. And once again, we refer to Allah's Prophet. And I'm going to refer to a couple of incidents that are very well known in Islamic history. The first one had to do with the Muslims after they were doing war with one of the factions of Yahud in Al-Madinah. And the Yahud took the side of the Grand Arabian Alliance that had besieged Al-Madinah. I'm referring to what is known in Islamic history as Al-Ahzab, the Confederates, or Al-Khandaq, the Trench. This is the well-known battle in which the Muslims were under tremendous pressure and their very existential life was threatened by the convergence of all the hostile forces in Arabia at the time. After these Confederate or Allied forces receded away from Al-Madinah, the Prophet of Allah, alayhi salatu wassalam, wanted to pursue this faction of Yahud who had written an agreement with him, Wathiqat al-Madinah. They signed onto it that they will not side with the military enemies of the Islamic State in Al-Madinah. But they did. So in this context, Allah's Prophet said to the listening Muslims, لا يصلين أحدكم العصر إلا في بني قريظة. None of you shall pray al-Asr except at Bani Qurayza. Everyone heard that. There's no dispute about this in any Islamic history book you go to. You're going to find that quote. All of us agree to that. But how did the Muslims interpret this? How did they understand? Some of them understood the Prophet to have meant what he said literally. That we're not going to perform our Asr prayer until we reach the stronghold of Bani Qurayza, which was at a small distance from Al-Madinah. It may have taken, in the atmospherics of war, it may have taken with an educated guess, about 45 minutes to an hour to get there. The other Muslims who listened to the same statement from Allah's Prophet, they understood something else. They understood the Prophet to have been saying, make haste. Go to Bani Qurayza as soon as you can. But he didn't mean we cannot pray Al-Asr on our way there. So some of them prayed Al-Asr prayer on their way to Bani Qurayza. And when they arrived, all the Muslims were now encamped in the vicinity of Bani Qurayza. It appeared that when they came to pray Al-Asr, some of them had already prayed. So this issue, remember, these are people around Allah's Prophet who were brought up with him, who knew exactly what he said. So when this issue was brought to Allah's Prophet, he didn't say one side is wrong and the other side is right. As a matter of fact, he endorsed both sides. Which means that there is room for we, the Muslims, to understand whether it's a hadith or whether it is an ayah, to understand it in a style that doesn't conflict with each other. This understanding we don't have within us today. we find that Muslims want to be holier than thou. Meaning that if someone understands something a certain way, that is absolutely the only way of understanding it. There's no room for any other way of understanding it. This does not have a basis in the conduct of Muslims who are committed to Allah and committed to His Prophet. The other incident that I will draw on from the history of that building generation of Muslims is the following. There were Muslims, these same mature, sacrificing, struggling Muslims around the Prophet. They went to draw water. There's a well of water, and they wanted to throw their pails down into this well and draw water. And then two individuals got into a dispute because someone wanted to draw water before the other, and they got into a skirmish. And then one of them said, "Ya lal muhajirin," and the other one said, "Ya lal ansar," which means, "I'm calling you on the you al muhajirin for help." And the other one said, "And I'm calling you, the Ansar, for help." Now, Al-Muhajirin and Al-Ansar are Quranic terms, and they are also a prophetic designation of these two camps that supported Allah's Prophet. Meaning, these are honorific words. Al-Muhajirin and Al-Ansar, these are honorific words. But the mentality that one of these persons said, he wanted to tribalize the Muhajirin, and the other one wanted to tribalize Al-Ansar. And then the rest of the Muslims, they sensed, well, this is not right. This is a violation of our togetherness. And they took the affair to Allah's Prophet. And he said, "La tarji'u ba'di kuffaran yadribu ba'dukum riqaba ba'd." He understood that this is the beginning of a slope into antagonism. And he was surprised. "How are you doing this? And I'm still among you. I'm still here. And I brought you out of tribalism. And you were given this distinction and this honorific, and now you're falling back into that tribalism and taking with you that honorific title that was given to you." And we are doing it. I mean, I can be very specific. I just don't want to upset maybe some sensitive individuals. I can be very specific about this. And this tribalism is being done to, we are doing it to ourselves, we the Muslims. If you're a Sunni, you want to make it a tribalistic, give it a tribalistic definition. If you're a Shiite, you want to give it a tribalistic definition. And let's be frank. We do have those elements among us. Allah Jalla wa Ala says, "Qul ya ahla al-kitab, ta'alu ila kalimatin sawa'in baynana wa baynakum." There's an ayah. As a matter of fact, there's a few of them in the Quran. "Qul ya ahla al-kitab," say, "O people of Scripture." This is in reference to those who had received divine Scripture before the Prophet of Allah, namely the Jews and the Christians. And we are saying, Allah is telling His Prophet, and by extension telling us, to say to them, "O people of Scripture, ta'alu ila kalimatin sawa'in," let's come to a common understanding, a common word. between us and you. If there is the type of tolerance built into the Book of Allah that we are commanded to approach people of Scripture with trying to find some common ground. We have some Muslims who cannot approach their own counterparts with this same understanding. It's as if someone has to stand up and say, قُلْ يَا أَهْلَ الْقُرْآنِ تَعَالَوْا إِلَىٰ كَلِمَةٍ سَوَاءٍ بَيْنَنَا وَبَيْنَكُمْ. Some of us have made the distance so far that it seems like the distance between us and Ahlul Kitab is shorter than the distance between us and ourselves. This is the public mind that we are going to have to reconstruct. And we're not going to be able to do that. And I've just given some examples on what I mean. Now I'm going to make a transition from the time of Allah's Prophet to our time. We have an Islamic leader who came to, first of all, he came to the people that he was living with, that were people who were living with him, and his concern was to rebuild an Islamic society and an Islamic state. Isn't that what Allah's Prophet did? He built an Islamic society and an Islamic state. And we, the Muslims, have been living for quite some time now without an Islamic state, and we can almost say without an Islamic society. And there have been Islamic movements in the world who have been attempting in the past century to put together this combination of society and state. Partial successes, partial failures, a step forward, two steps backwards. Things have been going this way and that way for the global Islamic movement. In this context, an imam comes, a leader comes, and he manages to put together an Islamic state in a geographical area called Iran. And in doing that, he had to put up a struggle with tribalists, the same type of people we were alluding to just a few minutes ago. He had to put up with these type of tribalists in addition to the avowed enemy that is coming his way from the outside. And this well-known enemy is imperialism and Zionism. Now, here's where we begin. Some Muslims, when we get to this area here, some Muslims begin to have difficulty with, how come you're speaking about imperialism and Zionism? Well, because they're facts of life. What do you want us? You want us to behave like an ostrich? Bury our heads in the sand and make believe there's no imperialism and no Zionism in this world? These are forces that are at work. And these are forces that are not leaving us alone. If imperialism and Zionism were some political entities at a distance from us, well, we wish them the best. We wish their subjects and their victims Godspeed in getting rid of this type of malignancy in the human condition. But it happens to be that Zionism and imperialism are located smack dab in the middle of our countries and our territories. You look at the world. This is how we're going to have to grow up. Look at the world. The hard facts of the world is American imperialism alone has between 700 and 1,000 military bases. Now, people say this. People who are conservative on the right of the political spectrum, and they can sort of feel proud that they are carrying Western civilization to the dark corners of the world. People on the political left say this, and they are critical of American expansionism and hegemony in the world. Well, why is it? If it comes to we, the Muslims, oh no, you're not supposed to speak about this. Who said I'm not supposed to speak about this? Where did you get that from? First of all, the laws that we have, whether we're Americans, I'm an American, or whether we're Canadians, most of you are Canadians, there's nothing in the law that says you cannot speak about Zionism and imperialism. Show me that. Maybe I'm wrong, and if I am wrong, I'm open. You correct me. But where does it say in the law, anywhere, we cannot speak about Zionism and imperialism? It doesn't say it. So we're going to speak about Zionism and imperialism. And we're going to speak about them not just because we had to come across some facts here and there. We're going to speak about them in a principled way. We have ayat and we have a hadith that point to these enemies. An ayat, of course, I can't be exhaustive here. I can't mention all the ayat and all the ahadith in the Quran. But just as a matter of giving you an example, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in Surah Al-Ma'idah, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا لَا تَتَّخِذُوا الْيَهُودَ وَالنَّصَارَى أَوْلِيَاءَ بَعْضُهُمْ أَوْلِيَاءُ بَعْضٍ وَمَنْ يَتَوَلَّهُمْ مِنْكُمْ فَإِنَّهُ مِنْهُمْ إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَا يَهْدِي الْقَوْمَ الظَّالِمِينَ. Okay, what does this ayah say? Now, most of you I know are subject to mistranslations. I've been spending many, many years in the context and in the content of the Quran. And the translations we have, believe me, are very inaccurate. As a matter of fact, some of these translations serve imperialism and Zionism very well. Because some of these translations say, Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O you who believe. These are the mistranslations. Do not take the Jews and the Christians as your friends. Now, I ask you, brothers and sisters, very sincerely and very cordially, I ask you, is this what the ayah say, Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, la tattakhidhu al-yahuda wa nasara awliya? We can't have Christian and Jewish friends? Does anyone in his right mind understand this ayah to say that? Of course not. Allah has given us the permission to marry people from Ahl al-Kitab. And marriage is the most intimate relationship there is. So there's a conflict here. I'm going to have a very intimate relationship with my spouse who is not a Muslimah, and I can't have them as friends? Of course, this is not what the ayah is saying. The ayah is saying, O you who are securely committed to Allah, Ya ayyuha alladhina aman. Not this, O you who believe in all this, O you who have faith. All of this is a secular translation that has to be swept away from our minds. It says, don't designate al-Yahud, and al-Yahud here is the political character of the Jews, which in today's world is Zionism. And al-Nasara is the political character of the Christians in today's world, which is imperialism. Don't have them as your allies. The word awliya and the word tattakhidhu has given a political definition to the word al-Yahud and al-Nasara, not a theological or a doctrinary definition. If we cannot grow into understanding this practical meaning of the Quran, then of course we're going to have problems. If I'm going to come and speak to you about imperialism and Zionism, then I'm probably speaking 10 years ahead of you. And I don't want to do that. I want you to be with me to understand what's being said. It is with this understanding of Allah and His Prophet that the Muslims in today's world anchored a state that is constructed on the basis of Islam. And then all of a sudden we have these forces in the world that are threatening this Islamic state. And that is, I guess, a credit and a certification of the authenticity and the genuine character of the Islamic State. The Islamic movement in the world has been experimenting with relationships that this has been going on for at least 30 or 40 years, relationships with nation states that are an extension or a sidekick to imperialism and Zionism. Primary among these nation states is Saudi Arabia. It has been financing certain Islamic activities here and there, giving the Muslims the crumbs. And some Muslims are satisfied with nibbling on the crumbs and then placing the overwhelming majority of its budget, its treasury, in the financial institutions of imperialism. I ask you, Muslims, very brotherly and very calmly, is it Islamically justifiable to put around $3 trillion, that's $3,000 billion, this is what the nation states of the Arabian Peninsula have, Saudi Arabia and its tertiary nation states on the Gulf. They have around $3 trillion deposited in the banks, in the financial institutions, in the transnational corporations that are recycling this wealth in the form of military wars against us. How are we to justify that? We welcome, if someone has a counter opinion, they can bring us ayat and ahadith that substantiate and that can defend this Saudi position. Please, by all means, come. Ta'alaw ila kalimatin sawa'. Let's see if we have a common ground here. I don't think so. I've never heard of Allah's Prophet placing whatever meager dirahim and dinar at the time in the budget of the superpowers, whether it's the Persian superpower or whether it was the Byzantine superpower of that time. It doesn't appear in any of our history books. So where do they get this justification from? And why are they upset and riled? Why are they agitated and uneasy when someone begins to tell them, and the Imam al-Khomeini, this is another thing, no one is supposed to speak of this. What's wrong with you? We're defeated psychologically, we can't speak about. Let's say if Imam al-Khomeini didn't come from Iran, let's say he came from Egypt, or he came from Turkey, or if he came from Pakistan, or Nigeria, or somewhere else in the Muslim world. Are we going to say, no, we're not going to support him because he has another school of thought? This is tribalism. We don't belong to this tribalism. We have to see the issues as they are. Now, I know, brothers and sisters, There are very sensitive issues. The last card now that's being played by the imperialist Zionist and their subsystems in the Islamic East, the last card that they are trying to play now is the sectarian card. They want Muslim Sunnis and Muslim Shiites to begin to kill each other. This is what they have tried to have going in Iraq. And with the casualties and with the very sad events that occurred from time to time and place to place there, the imperialists and Zionists still have not achieved their objectives. There's not a sectarian civil war in Iraq as close at times as it came to that. Now they're trying to move their theater of operation from Iraq to Lebanon. They thought in Iraq, this was the calculation of the Zionists and imperialists. They thought in Iraq, we're going to clean house in a matter of a year or so. We're going to set up a Shia regime. They're not going to call it Shia regime. They're going to call it a democratic, secular, free, modern state in Iraq. They'll find the fancy words to describe it. And then what they wanted to do from there is to move. The next step is to undermine the Islamic State next door in Iran through the Hawza, through the Islamic seminaries in Iraq. So far they're stuck. The American imperialist think tanks, departments of government, executive, military, all of them are stuck. They don't know what to do now. So they think, well, wait a minute here. It didn't work out our way in Iraq. Let's see if we could go to Lebanon and do the same thing. In Lebanon, they have another issue to deal with, and that is Hezbollah. This is another word that Muslims just can't have the composure that it takes to understand what they are talking about. Hezbollah is a fighting force in Lebanon, fighting against what? Fighting against occupation. It is sanctified by international law. For those who are weak in their minds and weak in their hearts, they don't want to take a look at what Allah and His Prophet are saying. Okay, run to international law. International law gives you all the justification and all the legality that it takes to fight against occupation. And Hezbollah fought against occupation and defeated Israeli occupation for the first time since the establishment of that illegitimate state on the dispossessed Palestinians and their lands. They're upset by that. So now what they're going to do is they're going to try to have a fight between Sunnis and Shiites commence in Lebanon. And they'll look back and say, look how unstable Muslims are. And this is how they think that they're going to make up for they're going to recuperate from their losses in Iraq. It's not going to work. I know now there's tension in Lebanon. I think for us who are living the events of the days, yeah, there's tension. But that tension will subside. I have faith, I have confidence in the Muslims that there's probably going to be some incidents and some events, but overall, that's going to subside. And the Israelis and the Americans are not going to have it their way. Of course, when we say Israelis and Americans, we're talking about the governments here, not speaking about the people. I'm an American. I'm against all of that stuff. What the United States government is doing in Muslim countries and the Muslim hemisphere of the world. So what are they going to do now? What are they thinking about? You're beginning to hear. They're beginning to think about targeting the Islamic State in Iran itself. Iraq is not, it hasn't gotten them anywhere. Lebanon doesn't seem like, you know, in the last skirmishes that happened in Beirut, about a month and a half ago, about a month to a month and a half ago, there was a very serious argument between Tel Aviv and Washington. Washington wanted Tel Aviv to interfere in this fight in Beirut, to spread the internecine warfare throughout the rest of Lebanon. And they disagreed very seriously about this, so now they're turning their guns over, came to Washington, sat down with Bush and began to give orders. You know, the Israeli Prime Minister always gives orders to the American President. The American President always follows through on these orders. So the orders were, okay, let's target Iran right now. And now they're beginning to say that there were some Israeli maneuvers and some Israeli military exercise, and all of this is intended to target some military installations or military bases in Iran. Then they're talking about Iran trying to produce a nuclear weapon. And you know what is in the media. I don't have to repeat it for you. But what we have to understand is this is not happening in a vacuum. Muslims have been able to anchor an Islamic state with all of the struggle and all of the wars that it has been through, from hot military wars now to the psychological warfare, and then anew the military threats that we are beginning to listen to. Let me tell you, the Muslims today are not the Muslims of the 17th, 18th, and 19th century. When colonialism left the European shores and went throughout the lands of Africa and Asia and colonized the Muslims all over the place. Muslims are not in that type of world any longer. Muslims now are beginning to resume their responsibilities. And if Muslims have managed, with Allah's supervision and with a leadership like the leadership of an Imam al-Khomeini, to establish an Islamic state, then this is our trust. We have to, for us to be supportive of the Islamic leadership and the Islamic state in Iran, doesn't mean that I'm going to have to be a Shiite. Let's get that out of our minds. You can be a Sunni to the full extent of the meaning and still be supportive of an Islamic state that is taking a stand against Zionism and imperialism. And no one's going to tell you, no one's going to say to you, you're a terrorist because of that, unless you are susceptible to that accusation. And I'm not. We hope that those days are behind us now. We're not going to be susceptible. Okay, I'm going to cower. Don't accuse me of being a terrorist. We're not terrorists. There's nothing in the book of Allah or in the quotes of His Prophet that make of us any terrorists. We don't have to be apologetic about anything. We don't have to be defensive about it. We don't have to be inferior when the subject comes up. And we don't have to be sycophants when they throw all of this defamatory language at us. Not at all. Be as confident as you can in saying, yeah, we Muslims now have an Islamic state in the world. Of course, we don't have it in many other territories, but it is coming. Whether they like it or not, it is coming. And it's going to come because we're going to have sacrifices and we're going to have a struggle. It's not going to come on a golden plate. Here, this is your Islamic state. That's not the way things are done. إِنَّ لِلْحُرِّيَّةِ الْحَمْرَاءِ بَابًا بِكُلِّ يَدٍ مُضَرَّجَةٍ يُدَقُّ. An Arabic poetry verse that says, red freedom has a door, and the hand that knocks on that door is a hand that is stained with the blood of struggle and liberation and revolution and sacrifice. That's the hand that's going to open the door of freedom and liberty. It's not going to be, oh, we're going to go to the White House and we're going to plead our cause with the master in the executive of the government, the United States of America. It's not the way we're going to gain our freedom, our independence, our liberty, our Islamic base, our Islamic state, and our Islamic direction. That's not the way it is done. It's not the sunnah of Allah's Prophet. That's not the way he did it. And they came up to him. Let me remind you, there were attempts by those who were the enemies of Allah's Prophet in Mecca. They said, wait a minute, what do you want? Are you looking for a position to rule? If that's what you're looking for, we will appoint you the superior ruler over us. إِن كُنْتَ تُرِيدُ مُلْكًا مَلَّكْنَاكَ عَلَيْنَا. And on the other hand, if what you are looking for is wealth, if you want money, fine. We'll put together a tremendous amount of resources and we'll give it to you. And then on the other hand, if you're obsessed with some type of evil spirit, we'll try to call in for you the best capable doctors or physicians of our time and they'll take care of you. To some people, individuals who come to these masajid today, and some individuals who ascend the manabir of these masajid say, oh, look, wait a minute, I think the Prophet made a mistake here. They told him, look, if you want to become the ruler of Mecca, we'll make you the ruler of Mecca. What else do you want? He turned that down. What was he? An extremist? Was he a fanatic? He turned what they were, he said, and they did this via his uncle. They told his uncle, go speak to your nephew. Tell him, this is the offer. We get, what's more generous than this? We're giving him all practically anything he wants. And in another narrative, they said, and even if you want, you know, beautiful young women, we'll give you that too. So they're practically offering this person anything a human being would desire. They said, no. وَاللَّهِ يَا عَمْ وَضَعُ الشَّمْسَ فِي يَمِينِي وَالْقَمَرَ فِي يَسَارِي عَلَى أَنْ أَتْرُكَ هَذَا الْأَمْرِ مَا فَعَلْتُ حَتَّى يُظْهِرَهُ اللَّهُ أَوْ أَهْلِكَ دُونَ. Oh uncle, if they were to put the sun in my right hand, the moon in my left hand, in exchange for me giving up on this struggle, on this affair that I am commissioned with, from Allah, I'll not do it. Until that day comes when Allah will have this affair supreme, or until I perish towards that end. The ayah in the Quran says concerning people who want to give and take with imperialists and Zionists, with al-zalimeen, with al-mushrikeen, with al-mustakbireen, the ayah says to the Prophet, وَدُّوا لَوْ تُدْهِنْ فَيُدْهِنُونَ. They would love it, they meaning your enemies. We had enemies in Mecca, and we have enemies in today's world. And the ayah says about them, وَدُّوا لَوْ تُدْهِنْ فَيُدْهِنُونَ. Their ultimate desire would be for you to equivocate, so that they could equivocate, or that you begin to negotiate and barter with them on these principles and these values, so that they could do the same. They came to him and they said, wait a minute. And they saw the tide of Islam, just like today. They see the tide of Islam moving and they begin to come up with some offers. Today they have offers. They go to the Islamic leadership in Iran and they say, look, what are you doing? You're building nuclear technology. Wait a minute, this is our offer. We'll give you this, we'll give you that, we'll give you the other. They're practically making all of this generous offer so that Muslims cannot consolidate the achievements and the successes that they have scored in these past decades. So he came to Allah's Prophet and said, wait, why don't we consider this? We can honor your Islam for 1 year, and then you honor our deen, our shirk for 1 year. That's something that opportunists would salivate at. Imagine someone coming in today's world and saying, wait a minute, we're going to have the system of Islam work for 1 year in Canada, and then we're going to have the Canadian system work for the second year. Wow! Many of today's leaders would jump at that opportunity. Man, that's a success story coming from heaven. That's what some of our spokespersons and our so-called leaders, that's the way some of them think today. But is that the way Allah's Prophet thought? No. One short surah came as a response to this offer. And it's a surah I guess many of you have memorized. You know that. قُلْ يَا أَيُّهَا الْكَافِرُونَ لَا أَعْبُدُ مَا تَعْبُدُونَ. Ibadah here is not worship. That's another word that is an obstacle to creating an Islamic social or public mind. Ibadah means to conform or to comply. So the instructions here are, say, O Prophet, O you who are in denial of Allah, meaning in denial of Allah's authority, in denial of the fact that Allah has a political program for humanity, I will not comply and conform to what you are complying and conforming to. And then the ayahs go on, which you all know. Suffice it to say here, I know I've taken more than the time that is allocated to me. They told me you have about an hour. I've run over an hour. I'm sorry for that. I'm not supposed to do that. But the subject matter, I think, is one that needs our attention, and it needs someone to express the truth. One of the Islamic scholars in the years of Islamic scholarship and intelligent ideas, he said this. I'm not going to say his name, but some of you are, you know, sensitive to names. He said, إِذَا سَكَتَ الْعَالِمُ وَالْجَاهِلُ يَجْهَلُ فَمَتَى يَظْهَرُ الْحَقِّ. If a scholar, meaning an Islamic scholar, if an Islamic scholar is going to be silent and the public or individuals are ignorant, then when is al-haq going to emerge? It's not possible. So the first step in having the truth and the facts emerge is for there to be a freedom of expression, where Muslims can express their mind and their conscience on the issues, the same way we have Muslims now on the front line who are expressing their mind and the conscience on the vital issues of the day. And then for the Muslim public, you and me, for the Muslim societies to listen to the truth. It's enough that we've had this truth in gangs for a vicious cycle of generations now. It is high time that we break out of this vicious cycle. We identify what is right and we support it. And then we expose what is wrong and we deconstruct it the best we can. This is the new dawn and the new generation that is forthcoming. We can see it on the horizon, and the writing is on the wall. Allahumma ja'alna min alladhina yastami'una al-qawl فيتبعون أحسنه. ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا، وثبت أقدامنا، وانصرنا على القوم الكافرين. ربنا ظلمنا أنفسنا، وإن لم تغفر لنا وترحمنا لنكونن من الخاسرين. اللهم لا عدوان إلا على الظالمين، وصلى الله وسلم على محمد وآله وصحبه، والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Thank you very much, brothers and sisters.